Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Good morning. Today we chat brain and brands. This is Unbranded. I'm Timothy Maurice, and we're so excited to be exploring the link between your sexuality and how your personal brand evolves. Now, you may seem like that is a random sort of link, but we're going to show today that the brain, sex, and your identity, your sexual identity and your personal brand identity, have an extraordinary link. As you know, on Unbranded, that is our goal. We explore the link between human and brand behavior. If this is your first time logging on to the show or downloading a podcast, we are grateful that you are joining us, and we are thrilled to be having this conversation today. My co-host for the show, not a special guest, but my co-host for the show, is Miss Jade Zwani. She is a life and sex empowerment coach. Welcome to Unbranded.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you for having me.
I feel like I sound awfully radio today. Let me relax a bit. Today's conversation requires that we have a real conversation. So I look forward to you co-hosting. I'm really grateful you decided to make the time to come through. And we're going to go through sort of the science of sex a little bit. You're going to offer some tips and some solutions. But for those who aren't aware of your work, you actually studied this sort of sexual education beyond your life coaching work. Tell us how you became interested and why you decided to get into this work.
Well, I was a late bloomer. And when I did start having sex, I thought it was fascinating. So I wrote a journal of some of my experiences and fantasies and then published that as a book. And after that did quite well. There were a lot of inquiries about how to perform certain acts and that sort of thing from a lot of people okay. that had read the book. And I wasn't qualified to help. So I applied for a life and sex coaching course in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
That I was accepted to and attended for 10 months, and yeah, and that's how I became.
And who was in this? Who was in this class? What type of people were in this class?
All sorts. I think there were lots of people who just, a lot of people who weren't necessarily going to use it to work with afterwards, but just for self-exploration, and and some people who did end up using it to coach and that sort of
thing. Got it. Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming in. I mean, there's a wonderful show on Cliff Central called Sex Talks with John T. Cyril and Tamar Gorin. So we're not going to talk specifically about the entire world of sex. We're going to talk about how sex ultimately impacts identity. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of picking up on the sort of the next level where they leave off. And my goal is to make sure that people understand that the body and the mind are deeply connected, and that your body and mind ultimately impact, you know, your behaviors and how you're perceived in society, and this sort of, you know, continuum between what you put out there, how people receive you, impacts what your personal brand ultimately becomes. So that's an important link, and I don't feel like people talk enough about that link. So let's start with defining sex. What is sex?
Well, I would say that biologically, it's an exchange of bodily fluids, but it's something, you know, it's something that we derive pleasure from, and not only that, but something that we can feel that adds to our sense of worth, our attractiveness, and our desirability.
Okay,
which is probably something that you're going to want me to elaborate on a bit later.
Sure,
so
sure, absolutely. I mean, that's a great start. I want to go into the 10 reasons why humans have sex, and we'll go through those, and we'll have some conversation back and forth. Are you ready?
Okay.
Okay, here we go. There are 10 reasons. The first is procreation.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be fruitful, multiply, have babies, and so forth, okay? Everyone knows about this one. The second one is pair formation. Now, this is argued by Desmond Morris, who is the author of The Human Zoo. He's an anthropologist, psychologist, and fascinating sort of thinker when it comes to understanding the relationship between humans and why we do what we do. So let's just go back. First one is procreation, having children. Second is pair formation sex, which is escalating and growing a bond between two people. So ultimately, you know, when you first meet someone, you know, you get to know them. Mm-hmm. And as you get to know them, it's just sort of a natural escalation. The third one is pair maintenance, to sustain and reinforce the bond. Okay.
Okay.
Fourth is physiological sex. It's basic buildup of sexual tension and relief. Mm-hmm. So you have this physiological release you need to have. And most studies show as many as 58% of females and 92% of males masturbate. We'll talk about that a little bit more and why this sort of physiological release of sort of tension, just sort of backup of sexual fluids is important. So that's number four. Number five is exploratory sex. It's based on curiosity and inventiveness. It's a part of our core instincts as human beings. We like to explore. We want to know what's out there. What's more? Can I increase my pleasurability? Can I increase my how I experience the world, the beauty of it? Can I experience more gratification? So we just are exploratory by nature. Number six is very similar, but it's different. Self-rewarding sex. It's basically returning to something that had offered pleasure. So it's like playing a game. The first time you play the game, you're exploring it. When you return to the game, you're doing so because you enjoy the game. Are you with me? It's fundamentally different. Number seven is occupational sex, sort of therapy. It is dealing with, it's having sex to confront the negative conditions we face in society. Society is often sterile and cold and nasty, so we try to escape that by having sex. Number eight is tranquilizing sex. Sort of instead of anti-boredom, this is more about seeking sex for anti-turmoil. So tranquilizing sex is, you know, sort of escaping pain or trauma or difficult situations. Number nine is commercial sex. Oftentimes people, you know, engage in transactional sex, sort of prostitution or marital gain, just physically marrying up, just all about sort of some sort of resource exchange. And then number 10 is sort of when one exercises dominance over another, sort of dominant sex. And in those cases, often sometimes you push the sort of humanity's boundaries oftentimes, and you can go into a space of an injustice or social injustice. But those are ultimately 10 reasons why we have sex. And I want you to be thinking about, you know, your sort of own sort of life and those 10 reasons as you're listening to this, and start to just sort of diarize why you are having sex, if it's only for one of those or two or three, because your relationship with how you engage sexuality impacts how you feel, your self-esteem, your confidence, and so forth. So, Jade, let's go back. The mind and body are connected in a wonderful ecosystem, and when there is a disturbance, a stress in the ecosystem, it creates disconnects and breakdowns. Have you experienced in your coaching that a lot of people feel guilty about their desires?
Yes. Some people think that they're not what society would consider normal or acceptable. Or some people are afraid that their partner won't necessarily feel the same way about their desires, which is why when I work with my clients, I encourage them to completely disregard their current partners, because it's about them and their needs. And
I see.
The worst thing that can happen when you're honest with yourself is, and your partner, is that they don't necessarily share your fantasy. But the best thing that could happen is that they want to do the exact same thing. And
okay.
They get to know you better, which is ultimately the goal.
I want to just sort of unpack, you know, how your sexual identity is formed. So the brain and the peripheral nervous system work together to build an individual sexual identity. Trouble ensues when they disagree. Okay? So when the nervous system and the brain, sort of what's happening with the body, there's a disconnect or there's a breakdown in the connection, that's when you start to have challenges. So I want to give one extraordinary example, which is what we call REGS. Are you familiar with REGS?
No, I can't say that I am.
Okay. So I'm going to go through it a little bit, and we're going to give the sort of the formal sort of scientific example on what it is. But it's basically, it's not sexual addiction, but it's ultimately when you have when you find yourself in a situation where you have extreme sexual arousal and it's largely uncontrolled.
Okay.
And there's a case with a young woman named Sally. She fell off the back of a motorbike of her boyfriend, and she was injured really badly. She healed and so forth, but she found herself in a situation where her body started to experience hormonal changes and so forth, and she found herself in situations where the environment would trigger extreme reactions, and she found her body shifting and becoming deeply, deeply sexually aroused without being able to sort of control herself. And this is one of the challenges we face. There's a lot of medical challenges that people are facing that we aren't aware of and so forth. Give us some examples of a couple medical cases. You know, any medical cases where people have found themselves, they were feeling guilty about something, but ultimately it was a medical challenge they were facing.
Well, I work predominantly with women who struggle to reach climax.
Okay.
And some of them have not necessarily medical, but sometimes it's psychological conditions. And sometimes it can be medical. But, you know, where a woman struggles to reach or climax because of medical reasons or more psychological than anything, yeah.
Okay. So you find psychology is one of the bigger challenges, right? So this particular syndrome is called the restless genital syndrome. It's recently discovered, and it's basically a mysterious disease that causes maddening sexual arousals for thousands of men and women worldwide.
Oh, wow.
It's a huge, huge challenge. It's recently discovered, and, you know, many patients with restless genital syndrome link certain popular antidepressants, selective serotonin, reuptake inhibitors to the start of their symptoms. Injuries or hormonal changes may also play a role in some instances. And this case with Sally, she found herself in a situation where she physically had to have surgery. And it's cost about 800,000 rand. Jeez. It's implanted inside of her, near her buttocks, to sort of calm the nerves and so forth. And it is sort of like a pacemaker. She got better, but it still persists on some level. So it helped her on probably about 70% to control. But this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation is I feel that, you know, in her case, for example, she had to quit her job. There was no medical aid that would cover her.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt an extraordinary sense of a loss of self-worth. And it really sort of impacted her career. And for her to rebound, she had to be able to sort of position herself in an environment where she could connect with people who understood her, that she could actually be able to take time off and engage and so forth. So such that she could sort of operate at a normal level. And I feel like there's a lot of people in society who who don't feel like they're understood, who are not able to operate as sort of a normal human being because their desires and their fantasies or their what's happened to them biologically is not understood by society. Do you think South Africa is a conservative society? Is it open-minded? Is it open to sexuality in general? Or do you feel like people suppress a lot of sort of sexual sort of instincts and understanding of sex?
I think generally we're very conservative, but with my work I find that a lot of women are curious and they want to know, but they're shy sometimes, but you know, sometimes some of them do have an eagerness to know.
Okay, well, what are some of the things you're coming across often that people bring up on a regular basis when it comes to some of their sexual challenges?
Besides the climax is women don't know how to masturbate or they're afraid to. And, I'm the biggest advocate for masturbation because I believe that in order for successful partner sex to happen, you need to have mastered individual sex. So this is one of the things that I teach, and a lot of women struggle with the shame around masturbating.
And sort of, have you studied the history of this and where it sort of comes from and why people feel so shameful?
No, I can't say that I have, but you know, women just feel like the one woman at a talk I gave was said she felt like God was watching.
Oh, wow.
You know?
So it's mostly religion.
Yeah. No,
it's religious.
Yeah, it is. And some of them, it's just not knowing what to do.
Okay. Not just physically feeling incapable or...
Yeah. Physically feeling incapable.
So it's a combination
of
guilt, strategy, guilt, strategy, and just sheer sort of understanding and freedom and feeling like, you know, understanding love. I think people can go to the sex talk show to really sort of understand. They've had plenty of shows where they've unpacked this. So my again, I want to talk about the practical realities and the challenges people face. So if you wake up in the morning, you're feeling deeply aroused, and you don't sort of masturbate because you're feeling guilty, it could impact your performance at work. It could impact your sort of lifestyle, your relationship with your partners, your relationship with your family, and so forth. Because people can, their bodies can become extraordinarily sort of not their own and so forth. So what sort of impact have you seen people who have taken your advice, and how has it impacted them on a sort of practical daily basis?
You mean the people that do masturbate?
Yes.
Well, a lot of the people that I've seen are a lot happier, and less stressed, and just generally happy-go-lucky, the people that do masturbate. And the people that don't release a sexual tension aren't as happy.
Ultimate, yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about the science of this sort of idea of climax and an orgasm, because I think this is really, really important. You know, I've come across a ton of studies that show that, you know, sexual climax requires silencing critical brain areas. Yeah, this is where it gets really, really interesting, because ultimately there are parts of the brain that are responsible for control, particularly in the prefrontal cortex region. And if you're not able to sort of allow yourself to feel sort of, you know, release your inhibitions, if you hold on to them, then you'll find that your body doesn't relax and respond and let go. So there's a great study, a testosterone study, where testosterone is a hormone ordinarily produced in women by the ovaries. It is linked to female sexual function. In a multinational 2005 study of women who had their ovaries removed, what women didn't know in this study is that they were given a testosterone patch. Now, one of the patches was a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the women who reported to have received or experienced her sexuality return because she had had her ovaries removed, said she woke up one morning after she had been wearing this patch, and she said, "It must be the patch. I'm able to make love to my husband again. I'm feeling deeply sexual." What she didn't know, that was a placebo patch.
Oh, wow.
So it was psychological, and the researchers suggest that her blockages had caused her to sort of disconnect. Her mental blockages and so forth had caused her to disconnect. And what this placebo did was cause her to sort of relax some of her sort of control regions of the brain and start to experience more flow and so forth. And I think the psychology and the challenges we face psychologically and the social pressures cannot be ignored. This is extremely important. What I want to do now is I want to go check out a song. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about sexuality from a bisexuality, homosexuality, is it genetic, and so forth, because it's one of the great challenges society faces. We'll be right back. All of us on some level, there are people out there who are asexual. There are people out there who do not experience any sort of arousal. But for the most part, most human beings do experience some sexual sort of arousal from our instincts. Today we are speaking about your sexual ID and how it impacts your personal brand identity. We are joined by a life and sex empowerment coach, Jade Zwani, and we're really exploring the link. Again, there are shows that really go into sexuality on much deeper levels. but we are fundamentally exploring the relationship between you, how you ultimately build your identity publicly and your sexuality. So that's the goal of today's show. We were just chatting before the break about some of the challenges people face, you know, reaching sort of orgasm, how it impacts them psychologically. And Jade, your client base, you have a sort of fairly diverse client base, young, older. What is sort of the average sort of age of your client base?
I would say maybe about 30, the average age, yeah.
Okay.
With obviously a wide range, higher and lower.
Sure, sure. And then do you feel like people in this, if you're 17, 18, 19, 23, 24, 25, that age range is not really sort of conscious. They just kind of having, I mean, not all of them, but most of them are just sort of enjoying sex. What happens around 30? Is that sort of work, life pressures, debt, and so forth, and all of a sudden the psychology around sex started to become a bigger issue?
I think that's when a lot of women come into their prime and they want connection and more meaningful sex, and they want pleasure from sex, and it's something that they're, you know, because traditionally for women sex hasn't been about pleasure. So I think at around that age you realize that, listen, there might be something that I'm missing out on and I would like to actually enjoy when I do have sex
instead of just
having it for the sake of the other person.
Yes. So let's go back. I mean, we were talked a little bit before in the earlier first phase of this show about the 10 reasons people actually have sex. And number one was procreation. Number two is pair formation, which is, you know, sort of connecting, building a bond with someone. And then there's pair maintenance. Number three, which is sustaining and reinforcing the bond. Number four is physiological sex, which is basic buildup of sexual tension and release and managing that through your physiology, which is extremely important. And we were talking here about the percentage of people who masturbate and who don't. It's interesting how 92% of men masturbate, you know, in most studies, and around 58% of women who masturbate. What do you find? What percentage of women?
Well, the ones who do admit to it, I would say probably about maybe 70.
70%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you think other women do it, but they call it something else.
No, I think that they honestly don't do it because, like I said, a lot of them don't know how to. And the female body is a little more complicated than the male body.
Yes, of course.
So it's not as simple to figure it out, and not knowing how to navigate your body is, I think, something that gets in the way.
Okay, cool. So that was number four. Number five is exploratory sex, and really sort of, you know, being curious and inventive and really sort of understanding your desires is one of the reasons why we have sex. Number six is self-rewarding, is, you know, once you have explored, returning to something that you enjoy, just rewarding yourself. Number seven, occupational sex. It's really sort of a therapeutic remedy for dealing with, bored spaces, sterile environments. Number eight is tranquilizing sex. Instead of anti-boredom, this is more of a anti-turmoil, dealing with drama and pain. Number nine is commercial sex. We know that there's things like prostitution, sort of resource exchange while people have sex. And then number 10 is dominance, to feel powerful. And again, this is where we find a lot of sort of social injustices against, particularly against women, where people try to be dominant, but there's also reversals, role reversals, where women also want to appear dominant as well. So these are the 10 reasons. And again, I encourage you to sort of really sort of explore what reasons why you actually enjoy it and become comfortable with yourself, to really sort of understand your instincts. So as we go back into this conversation, later we're going to explore, how do you awake yourself to your most authentic sexual identity, as we continue to explore this conversation around your link between your sexual ID as well as your personal brand identity? You said earlier, you know, sort of off air, that you don't necessarily deal with a lot of people who are trying to explore their homosexuality or their bisexuality. Do you find that it's a cultural thing, or do you think people are afraid to phone you?
I think people are just afraid to phone me, and sometimes people are afraid to be themselves. So, you know, you might find that you find yourself attractive to the same sex or gender, but don't allow yourself to express yourself that way because culture doesn't allow it, or because culture is restrictive.
Sure. We know for a fact that, you know, the LGBT community are fighting for, you know, equality and so forth. And this is an important, important conversation that we sort of understand it. I think there's a lack of understanding. There's a lot of religious sort of challenges. But I really feel I wanted to touch bases on this because I know so many people, you know, if you use that sort of phrase, in the closet, they're not happy. They can't. They're forced to sort of date people who are not necessarily their type. They're forced to sort of create sort of a social identity just to get along in society, to be accepted and so forth. So I wanted to touch on this. You know, there are 1,500 species in the animal kingdom that have been observed to practice homosexuality. 1,500 species. One of them is the bonobo. So you know the chimpanzee and so forth. But the bonobo, one of the most peaceful societies in the animal kingdom. Not the gorilla, not the chimpanzee, but the bonobo. The women sort of have sex with each other, and they make the men wait, the male wait.
They also masturbate quite a bit.
Absolutely. And again, they're one of the more peaceful societies. One of the reasons scientists argue, here are a few reasons scientists argue that animal species practice homosexuality beyond some of sort of the genetic instincts, is to diffuse sexual tensions, protect their young. A lack of choice at times when they're forced into sort of environments where there are just not many options to release tension. And studies show that the more homosexuality, the more peaceful across the board, not just in the bonobo spaces. Question becomes, do gays have a choice? Do gays have a choice? And the latest science really shows that the sexual orientation falls on a continuum. And you know, there are those who are exclusively attracted to members of the opposite sex, others to the same sex, and many somewhere in the middle. And social pressures often tilt people to one way or the others. But science also shows that genes do play a role. And ultimately, sexuality and genes influence where one falls on this continuum, and the environment can reinforce or allow you to be fluid within that space. And I think this is extremely important because, you know, if you really sort of explore the science of this, and the LGBT community have put out lots of reports and so forth, and there are people who have gone through some sort of therapy and they're able to switch their sexual orientation, who report living happily ever after. There are people who have gone through therapy who feel like their just sort of genetic sort of default is homosexual, and they cannot, and they're not interested in switching and so forth. And this is an important conversation, and I think it needs to be debated. I think there needs to be more honest conversation about it, and I think science needs to continue to explore this so that we can have a better idea of what's really going on. And the more we learn, the more we grow, the more we empower it and so forth. Do you have any friends who are homosexual?
I do, and I don't think for a second that it's a choice that they make, because I mean, there's so much hate around what's considered inappropriate behavior, you know, and unnatural. So I don't think that anybody would choose that for themselves. And yeah, so I can't say that it's
and I wouldn't ask you to decide for them. I think the question becomes, you know, how they navigate the world. Remember, our job on this show is not to you know, figure everything out sexually and answer every sexual question. But once you are having these social pressures, how do you get out there and position yourself? How do you navigate the world? How do you ensure that you can live a healthy lifestyle and ultimately achieve your goals and dreams? That's the conversation. What do you see them do in terms of making sure that they manage expectations? Let's say you have a boss who is, you know, who has a huge problem with your sexual orientation, or you have a person who doesn't want to give you a loan because they are culturally backwards and they have a sort of conservative view on sexuality?
A lot of my friends are very strong characters, and so they've been very honest and very upfront about who they are and their sexuality. But, you know, we were having this conversation the other day about whether or not you need to come out to everyone. And heterosexual people don't need to. So why should homosexual people need to? And, excuse me, it also is an invitation to criticism and hate and that sort of thing. But my friends are pretty much honest about their sexuality. And so I think that stops a lot of people. And they're very comfortable in who they are. They're very comfortable in their skin. And I think that kind of stops people in their tracks, you know, in terms of criticism and hate and that sort of thing.
Got it. So that is that's a good point. If heterosexual people don't have to come out, why should? And I think that's a challenge that the LGBT community faces, because the reality is that so both sides, there are pros and cons, right? So if you do come out, you can create more of a sort of a balance in society, so that people have other examples that they can sort of reference of what sort of the lifestyle is, so that they don't have these biases. But if you know, so I can see that there could be arguments on both sides. And I think this is where it gets really, really interesting. So, you know, we'll continue to sort of explore this conversation in sort of future episodes, particularly as it relates to the scientific research side of it. But I want to shift now to really sort of living your sort of optimal self and really sort of exploring and becoming comfortable with yourself and, you know, finding your sort of your authentic sexual voice. Share with us some thoughts on pursuing your sort of authentic sexual voice.
Okay, well, I think the first step is that you need to admit that you want sexual awakening and that you're not going to hope that it lands up on your lap or anything else, but that you're going to put in the necessary work. And then secondly, I would say that for the sake of your self-exploration, you need to learn to be dependent on just your ideas for this exercise. So if you have a current partner, pretend they don't exist. And then you put aside all learned judgments and criticism of yourself and figure out what it is that gets you off. And then you need to marry your desires with your integrity once you figure out what your desires are. So an example would be if you feel like, if you're married and you want to have sex with someone else, you can role play with your husband and pretend that they're someone else so that you make your fantasy as close to life as possible.
Got it.
And then last, you would integrate your newfound discovery or knowledge into your life with your partner, if you have one, or future partners.
Got it. And, you know, I want to stress this role. Like, for example, I mean, there are all sort of communities in South Africa and around the world who address these challenges and so forth. You have swinging societies. You have societies that, you know, sort of teach you sort of tantric behaviors, really sort of understanding the spirituality around your sexuality and so forth. And I would encourage you to explore those spaces quite intensely, really sort of find out, you know, which of these spaces sort of deal with you. And I think if you are in a extremely religious environment that doesn't allow you to sort of explore, you know, really sort of start to manage expectations and manage how people see it. Share content with people. One of the things I've noticed is that if you feel a particular way and you want to do something that is fairly extreme, that's outside of what your society sort of endorses or accepts as normal, by sharing research, by sharing content, sharing examples, sharing video, and educating people, enlightening them about what your desires are, they often shift and they become slightly more open-minded. So even if you say to them, look, I'm not asking you to endorse what I'm doing, but let's explore it together. So if you have a friend or a partner or a husband or a wife, you know, try not to sell them on it immediately, but ultimately say to them, this is a journey I want to take, and I'd like to involve you, and I'd like to share with you my sort of findings and my and the information that I'm learning on this, you'll find that they're far more open to it. But I think if you just say to them, you're crazy, you're bad, you're evil for not understanding me and my fantasies, you're going to have huge, huge, huge challenges. And the religion thing is something that, particularly with South Africa, is extremely religious for the most part. And I've noticed that any conversation around sexuality or anything, people often shut down very quickly. And I think one of the things I'd like to encourage is for us to understand the psychology of it a little bit more. In fact, I want to go through a bit of a study quickly so that people can understand that there is definitely some deeper science around this. And one of the studies is there's a neuroscientist named Hert Holstage of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He asked 11 women to stimulate their partner's penis until ejaculating while they scanned the men's brain with a PET scan, PET scan. The researchers saw extraordinary activation in the central regimental area, a major hub of the brain's reward circuitry, comparable to the feeling heroin gives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now imagine if a person is experiencing an orgasm and they are linking it to heroin, and then people are saying to you, you shouldn't have sex until you're married, but they've experienced this heroin feeling, there's going to be extraordinary conflict, and there's going to be a breakdown of understanding of themselves and so forth. So that's one of the first steps, is having an awareness. But when the roles were reversed and women were stimulated to orgasm by their male partners, the actual stimulation lit up areas of the brain involved in receiving and perceiving sensory signals. But when a woman reached orgasm, something unexpected happened. Much of the brain went silent. Some of the most muted neurons sat in the orbital cortex, largely responsible for self-control. So this is very important. When the women received orgasm, by being able to scan their brain, they saw that the neurons went silent, which means there was a release or a control release. This, mm-hmm. So decrease here is related to release of tension and inhibition. The scientists also saw a decrease in what they call the foramen prefrontal cortex, which is an apparent role in moral reasoning and judgment. So you're holding on to deep levels of morality and judgment of yourself could keep you from experiencing orgasm, because it means you're holding on to certain ideas that create blockages in the mind.
Which is why a lot of women suffer psychological issues when it comes to reaching orgasm.
So there was also a reduction in the amygdala, suggesting a reduction in vigilance. So the emotional region of the brain, the amygdala. Now, Holstage says fear and anxiety need to be avoided at all costs if a woman wishes to have an orgasm.
Oh, wow.
This is extremely important. He also goes as far as at the moment of orgasm, women do not have any emotional feelings. I thought this was fascinating. Now, I'm not going to say this is fact. This is just sort of a scientist talking. So I think one of the things that when he's talking biological feelings, not talking about sort of, I don't love you anymore. He's physically speaking about the fact that at this moment that there is sort of a muting of the sort of feeling, and the release has just sort of happened almost on automation. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So the big takeaway from this for me was that some of the control centers in orgasm were fundamentally different between men and women. That the release part was more necessary for women than men. The issue around morality and judgment was more critical for women to have an orgasm than it was for men. That was the big takeaway for me. So when you look at the 10 reasons why we have sex, ultimately women often find themselves being taught that there's only one or two reasons why they should be having it. And men are allowed to explore the entire continuum of those 10.
That's true.
And this is one of the challenges we face. And hopefully if you listen to this entire podcast, you're having an aha moment Because if you are taught that you're not supposed to have rewarding sex as a woman, and men are taught it's okay to have rewarding sex, you're more likely to feel extremely guilty and find yourself in a situation where you do not feel comfortable even having an orgasm when doing what you're doing. You may find yourself in a situation where you feel extremely guilty about even enjoying yourself, period. We have Jumian. He's on, this is Twitter. He says, I don't want to, I want me being gay to be the first thing that people see when they see me. I want them to see me as a person. I agree with you. I think this is very, very important, is that people, you know, I think the challenge, as we said earlier, there's two sides of the coin, is that on one side, you are allowed to be whatever it is you want to be. But if society has said that the default is heterosexuality, that means that they're going to treat you like a heterosexual. It means you're going to be in uncomfortable conversations. So I imagine that in 20, 30, 40, 100 years, we're going to continue to build where both will be considered a default. It will appear that both are normal. And by people coming out, that what happens is you reestablish and you restructure the norms. So I wouldn't encourage anyone to have to go out and take on that battle yourself. That's a personal choice. Mm-hmm. But just know that I think that to reorganize a society requires people to experience people to, and what it's like to experience sort of healthy examples of what's, you know, to experience people so that they can have a framework on how to sort of to even speak to people. Because a lot of people have never met someone. It's like in racism. A lot of people are racist because they just never experienced other people's cultures. So they have no idea. If you don't tell someone you are Zulu, they don't know how to speak to you when it comes to your cultures and your traditions. And I think that's one of the challenges that people face all throughout the world and throughout every aspect of society, is that if I don't know that what you're doing and what you're experiencing in your culture is fabulous and amazing, then I can't speak to it. If you ask the average person, why does, what Islamic faith practice what they practice? Most people couldn't tell you, who are not in that culture. So when it comes to the gay, lesbian, transgender, and bisexual community, I think awareness and a deeper understanding of the cultures and how they live on a sort of normal basis is really, really important. Any sort of final point from your side as a coach, someone who deals with it? Because you're not just a sex empowerment coach, you are a life coach as well. I'm sure you're seeing an extraordinary link between the two. When you said earlier that people, when they fulfill their most highest authentic self, they are happier, they're able to sort of perform better in their careers and so forth. But any other final tips you want to share?
When we grow older, we develop a sense of worth and self-esteem from our experiences, including our sexual experiences. And so sex easily gets caught up in the cycle, since it can equate another person's attraction to you to your self-worth. And if you're someone who hasn't developed a strong sense of worth, you're likely to fall into the trap of using sex to boost your ego all the time. So you need to develop a strong sense of worth, of self-worth, in order to have a healthy sex life.
Absolutely. I think the big takeaway for me is really pursuing a strong, healthy psychology, really understanding yourself, understanding the environment, understanding what's happening in society, broadly speaking, and being able to position yourself at the highest level of understanding and managing expectations of people around you as well. I think for me, in my own sort of personal experience, that when I engage other people and I hear them having conversations about sex and so forth, I see a lot of dysfunction and I hear a lot of dysfunction in the conversation. A lot of exaggeration, a lot of male bias and so forth, a lot of nonsense. And so getting through the nonsense to have a healthy conversation is going to be vital, I think, moving forward. Because whether you're in the workplace or you're building a personal brand or you're trying to be on the cover of a magazine or you're trying to be a receptionist, oftentimes people talk to you in a really horrible way because they make assumptions. Their lack of knowledge towards you impacts how you feel about it. I can't tell you how many people I've had come to me say they quit jobs because their environment is not conducive for them to be themselves. And that stuff bothers me. And it bothers me. And I wanted to have this conversation on the show because I feel that we have a responsibility to create a just and humane society for everyone. So whatever your sexual orientation is, your sexual ID and how you identify sexually, I think the environment should allow people to feel that they can be themselves. And I think that's why, you know, if you look at people like Kim Kardashian's or the Jenner's father, Bruce Jenner, mm-hmm. Caitlyn Jenner, one of the reasons why it became such a big story is that people can identify, even if you don't know someone who is experiencing what Caitlyn has gone through as sort of a transgender exercise, you can identify with just needing to be yourself. You can identify with wanting to be free to be yourself, to feel liberated. I think that's why it's a big story. And I think at the end of the day, we don't live in a society where people allow others to be fully themselves. And that's the reason why we wanted to have this conversation. It's hard to build your identity and your brand identity if you're not allowed to be yourself. A more just society is a society where people are able to embrace their full extent of their sexuality in a responsible way. Because then if you look back at those 10 reasons why people are having sex, there's one or two that you have to sort of question in the context of your own life. So thank you so much for listening to this conversation around sex. We're going to shift now to our cyber health feature with Rianette Lebowitz. Rianette, welcome.
Thank you so much, Timothy. Very interesting conversation that you had this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing with us and for always going the unbranded route to just get to the deeper stuff. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So I'm going to try today what we spoke last week, and I'm going to try and I'm going to record my session on this video.
Beautiful.
So we shared the information last week. If you missed it, it was with Victoria Gray.
Great show, by the way.
Thank you. It was really great to learn the techniques and tips on what's out there and how to film yourself easily on your mobile phone. So let's get into the cyber health feature. Thank you for joining me, Rianette. I'm from SafetyNet, and I'm really passionate about sharing messages to make sure that people are responsible digital citizens and that we become cyber savvy for the sake of everybody. Because when we like or tweet or share, we can either make someone's day or we are going to break their hearts. So let's think about that. Talking about breaking people's hearts and so forth, it seems that a lot of people are spending more and more and more time online instead of reading the papers and so forth. So I wonder how people in the printing industry are feeling. The latest statistics report from Effective Measure shows that South Africans with access to broadband spends more time on the internet than watching TV or listening to the radio. And this was published yesterday on 6 June on mybroadband.co.za.
Okay.
So Effective Measure is the official traffic measurement partner of the IAB South Africa and provides accurate traffic and demographic statistics for South Africa's top websites. And according to the stats, 22% of people spend more than 5 hours on the internet per day, higher than radio, which is 12%, and TV, 12%. I wonder when they work and when they sleep. Never mind when they have conversations. So the research further shows that people spend significantly less time reading printed newspapers and magazines than they do on the internet. My question is, what is the impact on our relationships? How do we actually take this and our new lifestyles and reinforce and keep our relationships alive? So I also found a very interesting article, which I have to share because it speaks to this question. And it was published on 1 June 2016 by Kaspersky Lab. And it says a third of consumers are willing to ditch their friends for their smartphones.
Wow.
Yet 93% willingly give away their smartphone PIN when asked, putting the safety of their digital best friend at risk. So how did they get to this? An experiment which asked participants to rate various people and objects in their lives in order of importance has discovered that 37% of participants rate their smartphone as more or equally important as their close friends. Not sure how I would feel about that.
I think, you know, for me, the reason why that makes sense is that your smartphone gives access to millions of people. So it creates options. And if the one person lets you down, you still have options.
Ah, yes. That's a good view. And yeah, it opens up the world. I mean, the results of the experiment, which was conducted by the universities of Würzburg and Nottingham Trent on behalf of Kaspersky Lab, shows that smartphones are set to overtake friends in importance. The experiment asked participants to position images representing their various people and objects in their lives in relation to themselves on a diagram of a chessboard. So while family, friends, and pets were generally placed closer to the participant than their smartphone, many other significant people in the participants' lives, including people they work or study with every day, took a backseat in comparison to their digital companions. So nearly a third of participants, that's 29%, said that their smartphone was equally important or more important to them than their parents, while one in five said his digital device equal or even more important than his partner.
Wow.
17% of respondents rated their smartphone in the highest importance category, although only 1% said their smartphone was more important than anything else in their life. So where does your smartphone sit? I mean, if you think about the importance and in terms of your relationships, and I guess it's coming back to balance, keeping perspective and knowing what's important, and look after the relationships. So thank you for joining us today, and please follow us at SafetyNet. It's SAVETNet, SafetyNet on Twitter and Facebook. And let's engage in this conversation because I think it's going to get interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the future of this is going to be that the virtual sort of world is going to replace, because people want to be more global and to be able to experience. And the idea of becoming more important than your parents is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
That is really, really deep. It'd be interesting to see what the age range is and how that plays out. If you're a 45-year-old, I doubt it's more millennials, I guess.
I guess, because we don't need to ask our parents questions anymore. We can ask Google.
Yeah,
maybe that's one reason.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to Unbranded. Thanks, Rianette. Thank you, Jade, for contributing to helping people live their most optimal personal brand by employing the techniques around living your sexual identity. We'll see you. Chat to you next week. Thank you.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.